Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00081. Recorded on May 10, 2024. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Chapter 81. Earls of Wisdom, Part 3. Earls of Wisdom, Part 3. Chapter 81.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88. This monologue is continued from the previous episode, Chapter 00080, Earls of Wisdom, Part 2. And now, the conclusion of the Earls of Wisdom series.
Alright, so I went ahead and bought the entire My Name is Earl on DVD, right? All four seasons on DVD as a gift to my wife. Because I didn't know. I didn't know she liked it so much. So I bought it for her, just to buy for her to have, for us to have, for us to watch and share together. No birthday, no anniversary, none of that. Just here you go. You like it, you got it, right? And I got to admit, and it's not hard to do either. Our time together, going through these four seasons of the show, watching it, has really been a blast. I like to see her enjoy anything that she's enjoying, right? I just like to see it. There's a lot of things that that I bring to her, a lot of entertainment things that we do, kicking back and off hours. And you know, I could tell her attention gets a little bit diverted. She's got the phone out and she's dealing with things on the phone. She'll look up every once in a while. But not so with My Name is Earl. She's watching My Name is Earl, right? So it's cool. She said she really, really likes it, and it's evident that she really, really likes it, and now we got it all the time. And yeah, we went through the whole thing already. I bought it for her, I don't know, 3-4 weeks ago we got it, and we went through all four seasons of them together, and now we're bringing it out again. It's actually watchable over and over again. That's how good it is. Again, My Name is Earl. It's from the 2000s. It's a comedy. But it's got a very sobering foundational premise to it that's very serious. And that makes for a really good combination. You've got excellent actors in there who can portray both comedy and tragedy exceptionally well. It works. It works good. It was a good thing. It was really a good thing. Few and far between. Few shows like it. And of course, it's kind of got that sort of quote-unquote redneck quality about it, which jives with people who, like my wife and myself. That's our culture. That's who we are. And you know, I know at some level, the production team of My Name is Earl was making a mockery out of rednecks, a mockery out of trailer trash, a mockery out of quote-unquote, which I hate, white trash. Trash in general, let's just call it what it is, right? Making a mockery out of the impoverished, making a mockery out of the have-nots of the world. It is. The whole thing, because I know. I come from up north. I got the Yankee attitude in my upbringing. And yeah, I know when somebody is poking between your ribs and playing it off. That's definitely going on right there. But I can say that they did a pretty good job of it. And I think any redneck or any trailer trash individual probably has a shared affinity for that, the television production, like I do, like my wife does. Earl somebody in the vaunted halls of redneckedness. Let me give you a brief rundown, just kind of get caught up, in case you are jumping in at the last episode, or in case you haven't listened to the previous two in quite a while. Just a very brief rundown, right? My name is Earl, like I said. Ran in the 2000s, late 2005 into early 2009, something like that. It was a four-season run. The main character in the story is Earl Hickey. And the theme, the premise that I was talking about, right, the foundational premise is Earl Hickey's initial learning of something called karma and a process of redemption he goes through as a result of it, right? And again, Earl Hickey is trailer trash. His brother Randy is trailer trash. Now, these were people were raised up in a suburban home with a mother and father. Earl Hickey was just, he was just trouble. He was a bully. He's a thief. Just a general scumbag of a kid, right? There's a lot of flashback scenes to the childhood. His younger brother Randy is a simpleton, damn near semi-retarded, and needs to be cared for, right? So his caretaker is his older brother Earl, which is really not a good situation for Randy, right? Because Earl's a piece of shit generally. So the stupidity of their antics, the trouble that they get into, a lifetime in and out of jails for petty crimes, petty theft, petty everything, renders them into a very low status in our society, right? So enter the whole trailer trash thing, right? Randy and Earl in the story end up in a trailer with a woman that coaxed Earl to marry her when she was pregnant with somebody else's kid. And while they were married, and while he was taking care of the kid, she was cheating on him with some other guy, and that other guy got her pregnant too. There's a lot of interpersonal craziness that just weaves in and out of the tapestry of the show. And season four starts to get kind of outlandish. It starts to reach a little bit. You get a little bit of that feel of jumping the shark going on. But still, it's worth watching. Still, I spoke earlier about season four kind of going over the top with the faggotry. It really, in some episodes, got exceptionally, even extremely gay. That doesn't sit well with me. I don't like that. But not every single episode is that way. But most of the episodes are kind of developed around outlandish interpersonal situations, right? Things just get kind of crazy. They really reach very far to make the most unlikely things occur, right? I don't know if I'm saying this well enough, but I don't mean to bag it. It's still funny, and it still has its moments of seriousness and philosophical things to deeply consider, right? The show takes place in this fictitious world called Camden County. It's never really assigned a state. It is certainly American. Camden County, the backdrop for where all Earl's world takes place. It's fictitious. It is stated succinctly as a depiction of quote-unquote middle America, right? But when you look into the production of this show, you realize that Camden County is actually out in the San Fernando Valley in California, right? The set locations are in and around the area of Van Nuys in Los Angeles County, California. And I think that's Los Angeles County. I should double check on that, but it's definitely in the valley. It's north of Hollywood over the hills. In fact, Laurel Canyon Boulevard creeps out of the hills and goes right through this area, right? For those who know, of you who know anything about Laurel Canyon, I'll probably be getting into that again in future episodes because I just got and read the book finally, but we'll see. We'll see where I go with that. So, yeah, this fictitious Camden County backdrop of my name and Earl, my name is Earl, while it's expressing itself as a depiction of Middle America, is really taking place in Van Nuys, California. All right, particular location details about it. Now, I talk about Earl and, of course, his tag-along brother, the simpleton Randy, living in a trailer park, right? But when the show really, when you get present with the show, the two of them are no longer in a trailer because Earl's wife, the pregnant woman with some other person's kid who lured Earl in to help support the kid and raise the kid, do the work and all that. That woman leaves Earl for the guy that she's committing adultery with. And Earl's left to find somewhere else for him and his brother to live. They move into this roach motel. I just call it a roach motel because it's really what it is. It is in a show and actually in real life, right? Earl and Randy's motel. It's room 231 of the Palms Motel, right? The Palms Motel. And the Palms Motel is an actual motel. It goes by a different but similar name. It's the Palm Tree Inn Motel in North Hills, California, which is just up from Van Nuys, next town over. I don't even know what they call it. Are those towns? Are those villages? Are those cities? I don't know. I don't know. California's weird to me in so many ways, right? But so it's a roach motel. And what do I mean by that? I mean, literally, it's like a roach-infested property. I found it, right? I found it on the Google Maps. And when you find locations on the Google Maps, you will often get comments. You know, when it's a commercial establishment, you'll get commentary by people who were customers, right? And they'll describe their experience. In large part, this place is bagged, right? It's disgusting. It's atrocious. Literally a roach motel. Roaches everywhere, day and night. This is what people are saying. Bed bugs. Wow, that's even a step beyond the roach motel. It's a bed bug motel. That's a bad thing, because that shit gets on you, gets on your clothes. You take it wherever you go, right? You got to burn everything. The bed bugs are horrible. It's a horrible situation. Oh, but raise your hand if you've been there, right? This is how I know. This is how I know. And these roach motels, all right, it's full of trash. You know, and when you watch the TV show and they show this motel, there's just garbage all around. They got this little pool full of algae and probably piss and beer. Never clean. Nobody swims in it. It's just sitting out there in the middle of the parking lot. Odd shape, like a shark fin. And there's just garbage strewn all over the place. And you know what? That's not a production set. That's the reality that they just plopped their cameras down in the middle of. They didn't have to throw garbage down. It's there. And even since the production up and left, right, it's still like that. They filled in the pool with concrete to extend the parking area. And because they didn't want to care for the pool, right? And because they were leaving it there unkept and it was still had water in it, it was probably a hazard for people. potential liability, lawsuits, shit like that. You know how litigious this crazy world is. I spoke about that in the previous episode. Just how things have become, how things can be at any turn. For whatever reason, they filled it up. And now it's just another section of parking lot. But it's a real roach motel. And I got to tell you, roach motels, and I can tell you by experience, it's a rung, at least one rung, below a trailer park. You know, it depends on the quality of your trailer park. There's different rungs of trailer parks as well. But, you know, your lowest low trailer park is going to be a rung above your roach motel every time, for every reason in the world. Roach motels are disgusting. How do I know that? By experience, right? Once upon a time, I was a fugitive for justice. And see, this is where it goes. You can have, and I'll get into some detail into this, you can have some kind of criminal background that makes it difficult for you to get a job, makes it difficult for you to get a car, makes it difficult for you to get a home to rent, right? And you could find your way into a trailer park if you put enough effort into it. But when you're beyond a jail record that's creating this setback in your life, when you're actual fugitive from justice, right, you're hot. There's some kind of crime going on, and if you get caught, you're in deep shit, right? So there's being a criminal, and then there's being a fugitive. Fugitives are who end up in these roach motels, right? They can end up, you know, if they find themselves a queen bee. I'll talk about that. But they can end up in the trailer parks, right? When I lived in a roach motel, this is up in Jersey. It was called the Rainbow Motel. Friends of mine who listen in may remember the Rainbow Motel. They knocked it down and put up a Taco Bell or something a long time ago. It doesn't exist anymore. But that was an actual roach motel. That was jump in the shower, try to wash yourself off, and while you're soaping up and rinsing down, cockroaches are running over your feet in the shower. You know, you couldn't put your clothes on the ground because a roach would run into your pocket. It's disgusting, right? It wasn't quite bed bug disgusting, I gotta say that. Bed bug incident came from somewhere else. I can't get into that right now, but because the CIA may be listening. It's just like that, you know. But yeah, I lived in that Rainbow Motel, which when I watch My Name is Earl and I see how they're living, it reminds me. Actually, I'm going to tell you, Rainbow Motel wasn't a bedbug motel, but it probably wasn't as nice as the Palms Motel was. The rooms were a lot smaller. It was a lot dingier in general. I don't know how to say it, you know. I remember when I walked in there the first time, there was a little black and white TV up on top of a busted up clothes dresser, a little bureau, I guess. And I needed to slide it over to make room for a boombox I had, because I didn't go nowhere without my cassette tapes and listening to music. So I was going to set that up in a prominent display. I moved the TV over, and when I did, a couple of vials of crack rolled out from under. You know, some drug addicts were living in there, and they actually lost their shit and didn't bother to look under the TV. So it was a greeting, you know, a greeting. I got roaches and I got crack. And I'm not going to say that the crack was a bad thing. It was a nice surprise at that time. But it gives you an idea of the place, right? A little idea of the place. Hey, amongst my friends from back in the day, I'm not the only one that lived there either, right? There's a couple of us that spent a little time in that place, some more than others. I was there about a month, 5 weeks, something like that. Just some of the old stories, I tell you what. Now, the trailer park, right? So now, Earl lived in that trailer park with this wife of his, and eventually had to abandon that and go live in this roach motel. But the trailer park remained really central to the story. In fact, the wife, her name is Joy, while she's not the main character, it can be said that the whole universe of My Name is Earl really evolved around her. She was the drama that kind of stirred everything up and kept everything kind of colorful and interesting, right? Very brazen, outspoken, no holds barred, redneck woman, right? Who was at the center of Earl's universe and every other character in this place, right? Everything just kind of revolved around Joy. The trailer park, the trailer in the trailer park was hers, right? And it remained kind of, again, the central location of the show. The three principal locations of My Name is Earl was the Roach Motel, Joy's trailer, and the Crab Shack, where Crab Man, Joy's, the husband that replaced Earl, worked at, right? So there was the Crab Shack, but it was the bar. It was the local bar. The trailer park in the show was called Pimmit Hills Trailer Park. Pimmit, P-I-M-M-I-T. I look at that, and I'm like, what the hell is Pimmit Hills? Did a little digging around. Turns out Pimmit Hills is a town in Virginia, and in that town in Virginia, the creator of the show, Greg Garcia, grew up there for a couple of years in his life, earlier in his life. So just he took the name from there. These guys, these television show creators, have a tendency to do that sort of thing. Nothing wrong with it. It just is what it is. But in case you were ever curious about it, now you know. I was. It could happen, right? The set location for the entire trailer park was actually an empty lot next to a church in Van Nuys. And I found it's actually at near the intersection of Louise and Roscoe. Roscoe is a main east-west drag across the northern part of Van Nuys. And all the way up in the northwestern corner of Van Nuys, there's a north-south road called Louise. And maybe a half a block under Roscoe to the east, on the east side, it's just this open lot. It's fenced up and closed. There's a couple of work trucks inside of it and some church next door to it. So they set up the trailer park in there, right? That's where the set location for the trailer park was. So down Roscoe to the east, and then up, there's some main road that runs up through that North Hills. That's where the motel was, which, again, it was filmed right on location in that Roach Motel. And I don't know where the Crab Shack was. I have to find out about that. It's not going to make it into this presentation, but I'm definitely curious about it. So, you know, now you got this whole redneck slash trailer trash thing going on the TV show. It's supposed to depict middle America. Obviously, it's done in California. And when you watch the show, you could see the attempt at middle America, but it's got that stink of California on it. Where in middle America are tall pine trees or tall palm trees growing everywhere you look, right? And that's the thing about shows. That's the thing about TV shows, right? The set locations, the production is done in and around Hollywood for the most part. And I got this other example that just happened to come up too, right? I start this episode talking about buying all four seasons of My Name is Earl for my wife. I also received as a birthday gift, right? My birthday was recently. I am now 57 years old. I'm old. I'm too damn old. Never been older than I am right now. It's really weird. But I received as a gift the entire run of Dukes of Hazzard, right? The old Dukes of Hazzard from 79 through, what, 85, 86, something like that. And Dukes of Hazzard was a well-loved show. It got off to an amazing start. There was actually like the first season was kind of run in two separate productions. The first five episodes were not done in California, right? Those productions were on locations out in Georgia, right? And I didn't even notice, and I got to say it, because where they did it, I used to live, and I used to go to school, and I used to go shopping, right? I used to go to eat. Unbeknownst to me, right? Unbeknownst to me. The first five episodes were shot in and around Conyers and Covington, Georgia. These are towns that are east of Atlanta down Interstate 20 on the way out towards Augusta and then across over into eventually South Carolina, right? Across the Savannah River. I used to live in a place called Madison, which was right down that line. And before you get to Madison, you got to Covington. And before you got to Covington, you got to Conyers. So out of Atlanta, you got to Conyers, Covington, Madison. What was it? Greenville and then Augusta. These were kind of like the main towns along that I-20 corridor heading out of Georgia, eastbound. There's a couple other villages scattered in between, too. I remember one. It was an odd name, like Social Circle, for an example. Buckhead. Not Buckhead, like where all the college kids go and get drunk in north of Atlanta in Fulton County, but a rural community called Buckhead. Just east of Madison. In fact, I think technically where I was staying was in Buckhead, but the mailing address, the post office, was in Madison. Right? I lived out in the country. It's a whole nother story, everything like that. But yeah, Conyers, Georgia, Covington. Conyers, I went to, you know, I got my commercial driver's license in Georgia. I had it converted to New Jersey at one point and converted again into Texas at another point. I do not believe my CDL made it to Tennessee, though. No, it did not. So anyway, I held a CDL in three different states there for a while. But I actually earned it initially as a result of going to a truck driving academy in, drumroll please, Conyers, Georgia, right? Conyers, Georgia, what I'm talking about. So I spent a couple of months commuting back and forth to Conyers and driving trucks in and around Conyers, no differently than the Dukes of Hazzard. But now Conyers, Georgia in 1978-79 versus Conyers, Georgia when I was there in 2000 and well, during My Name is Earl production, 2006, 2007. That was when I was kicking around there. Kind of different. It was a lot more rural. It was still rural when I was there, but it was a lot more rural back in the 70s, for certain, right, for certain. Covington, a little bit more rural than Conyers, but still had some vestiges of civilization in it. As I say, when you lived in Madison, you would have to oftentimes go over to Covington to get things done. One example is I got tires on my truck in Covington. I couldn't get them in Madison. Nobody did the work over there, right? But I was able to go over to Covington and get it. Anyway, so I say all that because, all right, now you had five episodes that came out in the first run of production for Dukes of Hazzard, and those are the classic five. Those are the episodes that people think of when they think of Dukes of Hazzard. They were very authentic. It was about the Confederate South and the good old boys, never meaning no harm, right? Driving around. It was a Robin Hood story. You know, if you really think it through and see how it's laid out, it's kind of like a Georgia / Deep South / 70s and 80s version of the Robin Hood story. We had the bad sheriff, and then you had these kind of commoner instigators rooting through all the corruption of the county, right? That was the premise, week to week. There really wasn't much of an ongoing story. Like, My Name is Earl, it's ongoing. You can jump in the middle of it and go and get along with it, but it would be better if you just start from the beginning, because the story kind of adds up as you go through it. Dukes of Hazzard, you could jump in any time. There's not really much of an ongoing story to it. Every week is its own story, and it's almost the same thing every time. It does get old. It's nice to watch every once in a while, grab an episode or two, and I'm happy to have it. You know, I'm happy to have it, because apparently you can't watch it on TV anymore because it's got the Confederate flag and all that stuff. There's nothing actually racist or racial about it. Other than that, there's a Confederate flag on the car that these guys drive around in. But a big enough deal has been made out of it. It's kind of been attacked by the old cancel culture, and so I'm not going to accidentally catch it on TV, especially when I don't watch it on TV. If I want to see it, if I have the sense, because it conjures up things in me. That's a part of my life. I used to live there, so when I see those first five episodes, and I'm not going to tell you, I know exactly where these places are. I've been there. I've been to the towns. As they drive through the countryside, I've probably driven those roads, but I can't tell you every bend in the road out there. You know, I could tell you it smells pungent with the chicken shit frequently up there. I knock the nose hairs right out of you. Chicken farming in that area is big agriculture, and the waste that comes with it is used to fertilize fields, and when they spray those fields with that chicken shit, you get your eyes burning for a good mile all around it. It's, I don't know if people get used to it or not. I never really did, but that's a whole nother story. I may have told it in a previous episode too. Not sure at this point in time. Anyway, you know, there's the stink of Georgia, but then the stink of California, right? After those first five episodes of the Dukes Hazard, they moved production to California, right? And you could tell. You know, the authenticity is just out the window. Now you've got the Hollywood Hills in the background, right? A part of Georgia that doesn't have much in the way of mountains, right? It's like the northern part of middle Georgia. It's underneath the foothills of the Appalachians. You're not far. If you drove north about an hour or so, you start getting into hills and things like that. But down in I-20, it ain't that way. It just ain't that way. There's no hills in any background. And, you know, it looks no different than the southern half of Alabama. It looks no different than Mississippi. It's just all pine trees everywhere, right? And it's not Texas flat, but it's pretty flat, right? You might have like kind of dales and things like that, but no mountains, no like backdrop of Appalachians or anything. So it's very weird. All of a sudden you go from episode 5 to episode 6, where everything was all green and lush. Plush, I guess, is probably the right word. I always mix that up. I'm an old drunk, right? So it's always about being lush. But everything's plush and green, you know, thick with foliage. I don't know if kudzu was quite yet a problem back in the 70s. You know, when I lived in Georgia, it was all over the place there, but I don't recall seeing it in the backdrop of Dukes of Hazzard first five episodes. You switch over to the 6 episodes, now everything is burnt up like a desert, right? It's completely different foliage. All kinds of odd trees and weird things that you wouldn't see in Georgia at all. There's no pine trees. It's completely different. And every scene outside has some kind of mountains and hills in the background. Everything is different. And like I said, it's inauthentic. It has nothing to do with the South. It lost that flavor. The only thing left of it is the Confederate flag on the Duke boys' Charger, 69 Charger that they drive around in, and then the accents, right? It's just the stink of California. That's what I'm talking about. Earl Hickey, my name is Earl. They try to depict it as Middle America, but it had that stink of California on it. You really couldn't hide it. And the same thing happened with the Dukes of Hazzard. That's the whole point I'm trying to make here, you know? The only real interesting vestiges that were left of in the Dukes of Hazzard was the music, right? The music in the Dukes of Hazzard is great. Nobody talks about this. We all know the narrator of the Dukes of Hazzard, right? Which is called the Balladeer, is Waylon Jennings, right? Waylon Jennings, one of my top 10, like one of my Mount Rushmore of musicians, right? Love Waylon, just do. All of the music is also done by Waylon. Not only does he narrate the stories, he wrote the theme song, the story of writing a theme song. He was taking a shit on the toilet and just wrote it down like on toilet paper or something like that while he was sitting there. He worked out this whole theme song, which is very famous now. I started singing it earlier. I used to play it on guitar and sing along in a previous iteration of podcast that I did once upon a time, right? Facebook Live version of podcasting. So, that quickly. Waylon was a great songwriter. Most of the songs in his catalog are covers. But if he had the need to sit down and write a song, he wrote some great songs with the greatest of ease. I wish he would have done more in his life with that, you know? But anyway, he's one of my top 10. I bring up about Waylon because a lot of people understand about that theme song. They understand that it's Waylon's. They understand about the balladeer / narrator of the Dukes of Hazzard as being Waylon. Waylon's just got that great voice, right? Just got that. When he talks, he doesn't even hardly have to sing when he sings, because him and Johnny Cash both, they just got those great speaking voices that you kind of just drag out a little bit and make it sound like it's singing, and it just works. They're just gifts. It's blessings, right? Blessings these two guys had. But more than just Waylon narrating and Waylon making a theme song, all of the music was done by him and his band, the Waylors, right? W-A-Y-L-O-R-S. You got Trailers and Waylors. and that's what we're all about right now. Except now with Waylon Jennings doing the Dukes of Hazzard as part of California production, right? The good thing is you've got the music, you've got the band behind him. Waylon had the greatest slide guitar player in the world. He's actually distinctive. Slide guitar is not a very distinctive instrument from one player to the next, but you could tell Waylon's guy anytime, any day, right? Guy was fantastic. And Richie, what's it, Albright, I think he was always Waylon's drummer, also did a lot of the production for Waylon throughout his career, and he did the musical production on the Dukes of Hazzard for the music there, and so it was all about Waylon Jennings' music. So you just listen to it, you know, you can just close your eyes, forget about the story, because it's the same Robin Hood thing over and over again, and the music in the background, just the country jamming that they do, and they're riding around in the car, it's all Waylon. It's great. I love it. Right? I love it. So you've always got that value, even if the authenticity was thrown away when they moved production out to California. Another weird thing, I just mentioned about Laurel Canyon Boulevard going through. When the production was moved out to Los Angeles, Waylon moved out there too. And he was living in the Laurel Canyon of all places. And this is during the heyday of his cocaine years. And I hate to think of how involved with some of the nefarious shit of Hollywood that my man Waylon may have gotten involved with, right? I've never heard any talk about it, but it's hard to imagine somebody just kind of sliding into that scene, having a good old time, and sliding out of it unscathed. It's hard to imagine, but that's all speculative. Let's just leave that behind right now. So anyway, the storyline in My Name is Earl is Earl Hickey's pursuit of redemption, right? That is the quite serious underlying foundational premise of the entire TV show, right? And while Earl Hickey is clearly the main character, I mean, after all, My Name is Earl, the world of My Name is Earl, like I said before, it does not revolve around Earl Hickey. It actually revolves around Joy Darvill, or Joy Hickey, or Joy Turner, depending on who or who she isn't married to at any particular time, right? Multiple marriages, infidelity, children from different fathers, different mothers, it's all a part of trailer park culture. It truly is. It is. And there's reasons for it, right? But Joy Darvill, she's the center of the My Name is Earl universe. And I want to explain exactly what I mean by this. I call it the drama queen B element, right? So you got a drama queen bee, as opposed to just a regular queen bee. Both of them exist. Both of them are fixtures in trailer parks, but they're two different things, right? The drama queen bee is a woman who... How do you even say it? The drama queen woman is the one that needs drama, and she drives drama, right? She always has this way of drawing problems toward her and having like emotional responses to it. And the people around her get drawn into that also. And here's the reason why. Because so many of the people around the drama queen bee are in need of what she provides, right? Drama queen bee is not necessarily a bad thing across the board, right? If you like drama, it's a good thing. I don't like drama, right? I don't like drama. And I talked, there's a difference between a drama queen bee and just a queen bee. When I met my wife, she's a queen bee, right? In this scenario. And I'll get to that. But then there's the drama queen bee that really brings a lot of color and animation, emotionalism to the existence of the people around her. The people around her, all right? It's a snapshot of trailer park life. Trailer park life involves low class, low status, poverty, right? Poverty and below the poverty line. That's kind of your social status in a trailer park. So you have that poverty. You also have thievery, right? Because how does this happen? All of this is going to be, like, I'm going through these attributes now, trailer park life. They're all, which came first, the chicken or the egg? They're all attached to each other. They all beget one another. It's this entire cycle of you know, this abominable snow ball rolling and rolling and rolling of tumult, of problems, of drama, right? I don't really know how to well explain it all, but let me just run down the list, right? There's a list of attributes commonly associated with trailer park culture, right? Like I said, poverty and thievery, right? Filth, I mentioned, drama, all right? Wild children. I could probably word this better, but you've kind of got, well, undisciplined children running around. Why would that be so? Because there's a lot of single parenting. Single parenting, more often than not, is a single mother trying to raise kids. Now, what happens with a single mother, invariably, is kids don't have discipline, right? Because discipline is a male paternal attribute. A mother, a maternal person, can ground, can punish, can slap the ass of, or the face of, a child as a form of discipline. But discipline is really more than just that, right? That stuff is often a knee-jerk reaction, emotional within the moment. Discipline transcends emotion, and it transcends moments, right? It's not really a part of the womanly composition. And if you doubt me on this, hey, you know what? Go ahead and try it. Try it. Or continue to lie to yourself about it. I have played the knight in shining armor in so many broken families throughout my life. I've always been the element of discipline everywhere I've gone. I've straightened up situations that were running amok. And it's not because I'm just so blessedly gifted. It's just a part of my masculine composition. This is what I do. If a kid is being a problem, for example, all right, you get no PlayStation till Friday night, right? For a whole week, you got no PlayStation, right? The kid, pisses and moans. He doesn't like it. He hates it. and hates me, hates whoever is laying this quote-unquote discipline upon him, you know? Now, when the mother does that same thing, he reacts the same way, but the difference is he'll come back in 15 minutes and tear on his mother's heartstrings and convince the mother to let him play his video games. A strong woman will not cave in until he comes back the second or third time within a half hour later, right? But the woman almost always caves in. The woman almost always never sees it through all the way till Friday. She is not about to put up with this kid tearing at her heartstrings every 15 minutes for the next 7 days, right? And he'll do that because he knows that's the way, that's the route to get what he wants. She will concede eventually if he persists at it, right? With a man, it doesn't fly. He may come back in 15 minutes one time. And when he's told to go piss up a rope, talk to me a Friday night, that's how it will be forever forward. And sooner or later, whatever it was he did to get himself in that predicament, he will think about it before he does it again to avoid that predicament. Now, of course, the sly kid may just, you know, reason ways of getting away with it. But over the course of time, he'll probably just stop doing it altogether, right? But this is how discipline works. It's over time. It's beyond time. It's bigger than time. It's bigger than the moment. It's bigger than emotions. You have to really persist. You make a rule, and that is the rule you go by, and you stick to it because it was right to do. It's right for everybody across the board. It's right for the child who even hates it, right? She ended up with wild children in these single mother scenarios. And the best bet for them is the mother to bring somebody into her life, a romantic partner, or maybe like even a brother who can be like the uncle or her father, a grandfather, something like that, a male figure to apply discipline. But the problem within the trailer park is often these men are children themselves, wild children. They were not disciplined. And they're not really skilled at the discipline. They don't really appreciate the souls and hearts of other people enough to really carry it through. It's iffy. It's in their nature to do, but they're so corrupted and undisciplined that they might not do it. They may hold out a day or two and then just capitulate because they don't care. I'm not explaining it very well, but some men are better than others when it comes to this stuff, right? I happen to be very good at it. I'm very stoic. And no means no. No means no. No means no. And the next thing was immature men, so I was just getting into that too, right? If you are raised without discipline as a boy, you are a man without discipline as well, right? Drugs and alcohol, of course. Beset trailer park society. Promiscuity, right? We talk about single mothers with multiple husbands, multiple partners. You got children from three, four, five different fathers. Often it's prostitution. I mean, to that degree of promiscuity, all the way to the end of that spectrum, there's that involved. There's husbands cheating on wives all the time, right in the neighborhood, right? Two trailers down. Your wife has run off with this other guy. His wife is with the guy across the street. You know, it gets to be crazy, right? It can be very crazy like that. Domestic violence as a result of all that. People are drinking. Their pride is hurt. They're scared. They lash out in violent rages, right? Violent fits. So you get the domestic violence. With all these things, you know, particularly thievery and drugs and alcohol, potentially prostitution, the domestic violence. People end up with jail time, criminal records, and then they're kind of trapped. They're trapped at this status level, this low level of society, this trailer park culture. They can't break out of it because they don't have the credentials to escape anymore. Once you have a jail record, it's very difficult to get jobs. It's very difficult to get housing. It's difficult to get sane and stable romantic partners. and you end up trapped in and amongst people with the same problems, right? And this is how this society forms, and then it propagates the same way, right? Now people get pregnant, they have children, they're raised up in this circumstance, and they often will follow through with the same problematic and dramatic lifestyles. And then the next generation comes along, and it's all the same. The only thing that changes really along the way is faces and little cultural sub-variants, you know, different music, different food, right? Depending on who comes into your particular neighborhood. But it's all always going to be low class, at or below the poverty line culture. So you end up with generations of people like this, and it becomes this assembly of desperados, right? I keep using that word, desperados. These are people in need. These are people who are desperate, and that desperation drives the aspirations. You know, so much as just to get a meal to eat. Of course, to get drugs and liquor. You know, I did these kind of things when I was a kid. I used to break into houses. I used to steal stuff, like money, things I could sell, liquor straight up if they had like a liquor cellar, a wine cellar, you know, liquor cabinets, beer in the refrigerator, beer in the garage. I would steal to get high. And if I did it then, I know people are doing it now. Things don't change like that, you know. Our character ranges from bad to good and everything in between. And that doesn't change generation to generation. Just style points are different, right? I use that word desperado. It reminds me of the Eagles song, Desperado, right? The Eagles... Laurel Canyon Band, again, California, just underneath Van Nuys. Waylon, I just mentioned Waylon Jennings spending a little bit of time there while he was involved with the Dukes of Hazzard. And then I just read the book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, right? The Laurel Canyon. Desperado, right? The thing about these desperate people, these desperados, is they need a surrogate mother, right? Their mother who didn't discipline them, their mother who was crazy themselves, their mother who is back in the trailer park where they grew up and not present with them now. The desperado, wherever they are, and they're often wanderers or often roamers, like me, right, need a mother of some sort, a surrogate mother, somebody to play that role, to replace it, because, like I said, the men who are raised in these environments end up being immature for years and years and years, for reasons I already expressed, and other reasons also, right? Their upbringing is a reason, their prison record is a reason, their lifestyles and habits with the drugs, the alcohol, the domestic violence, all the drama, the stealing that goes on because it's hard to get a job. When you got drug problems, it's hard to keep a job even if you get one. The jobs that you get are the menial jobs that really blow, right? You know, just think of something like my job really sucks. I've got the kind of job that trailer trash would have, okay? I'm doing all right. I'm not complaining about it, but I'm just saying it's a very low status job. There's worse jobs than this to be had. But this is how it goes for low income status people, right? You get that kind of work. It's not very compelling. It's a real challenge to get up day after day. And I can only imagine in myself, if I had a couple of beers, the hell with this. I wouldn't last at it. There's no way I would last at this. You know, and the minute somebody disrespected me on the job, no chance. I would not tolerate that anymore because, you know, if I'm drinking, I would be so far removed from Christ. You take Christ away from me. You take my principles away from me. You take my ambitions away from me. You take my care. I become completely selfish. I wouldn't even care genuinely about my own wife, who I cherish now as I am, right? Everything goes out the window when I start drinking. And I got to really think a little bit how I would be, how I used to be, how that translates and transposes to now. There's no chance. Like, I'm 8 years into this job. There's no way I would have made it 8 days. There's no way. No way. And this is how it is for so many dudes in the trailer parks. If they get a job, it's a shit job. They've got a shit attitude, and they're not going to stick with it. It's easier for them to steal, or how we started off this whole series with, panhandle, right? Panhandling, which is becoming more fad and fashion in these post-COVIDian years. So the desperado needs a surrogate mother, somebody to take care of him and try to continue to raise him. And of course, the maternal instinct in people, even if they're broken, even if they're low status, the nature is to actually provide that nurturing and that care. The Eagles song mentions the Queen of Diamonds and the Queen of Hearts. You know, watch out for the Queen of Diamonds. And the Queen of Hearts is always your best friend or your best bet. I forget exactly how the words are. But what's the difference between the two? You're looking at cards, right? You're looking at poker cards, playing deck. But they're based off of also tarot cards, right? You bring it back to history of them. There's a link between tarot cards and poker cards. And you have the Queen of Diamonds. In tarot, they're called the Queen of Pentacles. Everything about pentacles and diamonds is about money and opportunity and greed and, you know, avarice. All the mammon, the word I used before. I'll probably come around to that even again before we get out of here, right? So the person who's out for themselves, they're out to profit. They're looking for opportunities to take, right? If you're a person in need, the last thing you need is a vampire drawing the blood from you, right? You need somebody giving. You need a giver. So you watch out for that woman who's going to be taken, and you find the one who's the Queen of Hearts, which is really at the level of emotion and nurture and care. How do you really express that? I keep wanting to throw the word love in there, but I don't really affiliate love with tarot, right? And I'll get into this too. Okay, love is a very, very serious thing, which we completely misconstrue. It's a word we throw around so casually and use it so incorrectly, like karma, but probably even worse, right? Probably even worse. I preached a sermon on love one time. It was supposed to be 15 minutes. I think it went like 90. That's who I am. There's so much to be said about these things. I got to be careful, right? That's why my episodes are running over 4 hours now. I have to split them down into three parts. It's just how I roll, right? But the Eagles song, you know, you got to find someone to love you. You better find someone to love you before it's too late, right? They need that love, you know, what we call love, fondness, affection, nurturing, care. They need to be cared for, nursed, back to health, right? So the opportunistic woman is going to try to steal your gold chain, go through your wallet, whatever value you have of any kind, they're going to just take it from you, right? The vampires, bloodsuckers. And if you got no value at all, they'll be soon rid of you, right? You need to find somebody who really has it in them to be a genuine, authentic mother. However twisted, however dramatic, however problem they may be, you know, psychiatric issues, addiction problems, abuse issues, all this kind of stuff, part parcel for trailer park culture, right? But still, even still, a person can be an authentic maternal figure in spite of all of those nuances, right? And that's the kind of person a desperado needs to try to pull his self together. Now, the surrogate mother in My Name is Earl is this Joy Darvill, right? Earl's ex-wife, the wife of Crabman. She's harsh, she's direct, she's brash, she's mean, cruel, nasty. She's the drama that energizes the whole world of My Name is Earl, and in that trailer park especially. And yet she is the mother figure to all the characters, right? The guy she's married to, she's the mother figure to. How do you get that? Look, I think of my wife, right? I'm bringing her up a lot in this episode because this has a lot to do with us, all this stuff that I'm talking about, right? The interrelation between my wife and I is special. It's like nothing I've ever known before. And it's something I could talk about for hours and hours and hours also. There's so much depth and meaning to it. But, you know, all these women I've, in my life, all these girlfriends I've had, these wives that I've had, living partners, you know, significant others of every sort, they were girlfriends, they were wives, and that's who they were to me. But this one here, under God, in covenant with God, you know, it's God's marriage, and we are the participants in this, a whole different mental approach. She's not just a wife to me. She was my girlfriend, she was my fiance, she's my wife. She was never just that romantic partner. She's every woman, every kind of woman there is for a woman to be. This one is to me. She is my wife. She is also my mother. She's my aunt. She's my sister. She's my cousin. She's my best friend. She's my daughter, right? All this stuff, all the different roles and what they mean to me, and then how I interact with them. And you know what? You turn it all around, and I'm all this stuff to her, too. I'm not just husband, but I'm also father and son and nephew and uncle. I'm all these people to her also, right? You understand how that goes? When it's special, this is what special looks like, right? This is how significant that woman is to my life. She's all this stuff. And you know what's good about it? She's very good at all those roles. She's clear of conscience. She's sober of judgment. I got no worries in her at all. She's so stable, right? Far from a drama queen, but a queen bee nonetheless, right? But going back to this Joy Darvill, right? It's Earl's ex-wife who divorces him in the first episode and then marries his friend Darnell. Darnell's Crabman's name, right? During the first season of the series. She is pessimistic, cold-hearted, stubborn, and vain. Joy is the mother of two boys, Dodge and Earl Jr. She drives a Subaru Brat painted with the American flag, right? Really funny, a Brat. That's an 80s Subaru combo of like a small pickup and car. It's like a small pickup, low rider, and it had seats in the back that faced backwards out, like old station wagons used to have that flap-up seat. We had one guy in our crowd that drove around in a Subaru Brat. He kept it nice and everything like that. And for kids, it was kind of cool, right? It was kind of cool. But you didn't see that around for 20 years or so. And it pops up in this show. And that's Joy Darvill's car, right? It's kind of funny. But, you know, this is, I picked up somewhere online that little snippet about Joy Darvill. What I've got to say about her has a lot more depth, right? She's really a great character. She is all this negative stuff, but there's a lot of subtle positivity to her, too. There's a lot of authenticity. There's that word again, you know. A lot of soul, a lot of heart. A good character, and portrayed very well by the actress. What's her name? Jamie Presley. Like, all right, Jamie Presley. Yeah, really good work. Now, I brought up, I keep bringing up about the single motherhood in these trailer park situations, right? With that single motherhood, you end up getting this generational trailer trash, right? Single motherhood becomes a norm in a society like that. And of course, single motherhood has broken out of trailer trash society. And it's also in the suburbs and everywhere, right? Single motherhood is a problem because of discipline, right? It's a lack of discipline problem. It really does take two. It takes the completeness of a mother and a father, of a feminine and masculine. These are absolute roles that are totally necessary for the complete upbringing of a child. If you have any hope at all being quote-unquote healthy, you know, psychically, spiritually, psychologically, emotionally, it all begins with a balanced and stable home life. It's the environmental impact on your psyche. That's a reality. So in the trailer parks, where you've got a propensity towards a single motherhood, you end up with the propagation of generational trailer park trash, trailer trash culture. Because, you know, your single mothered daughter will become a single mother herself. And that's how it works. Mothers and daughters, they take on their feminine roles within that culture, and they end up repeating what the generation before them did so often. Even if you don't want to, so much of that happens anyway. It's ridiculous. I never wanted to be anything like my father. And there I was in my 30s. I was like, I'm so much like my father. How did this even happen when I actively tried not to be? Right? Now, there's so many ways I'm not. But there's just some ways I am. And I just can't seem to do nothing about it, right? And this whole trash thing, really, I talk about it being generational, but it's not a blood thing. You're not getting the genetics from your mother or your father that make you a low-class citizen. It's not genetic. It's not blood. You know, it's in the heart. It's generational. There's a goodness to it, right? Going back to the all shucks factor that I described in the previous episode, right? The all shucks, they're kind of like that good and the bad mixed together. That's so endearing to people. Like, you know, Elvis, for one example, that I used. A lot of this boils down to the premise of simple living, right? People who are trailer trash, people who are low in status, are surprisingly content with that, right? You would think, as somebody of a higher status, well, why don't these people just get up and change? Well, believe it or not, there's people that don't want to be like you, okay? There's people who don't want to have their life evolving around the pursuit of creature comforts and money, increased status all the time, and all the stress that comes with it, and all the emptiness, frankly, that comes with it too. Simple living is just being down home, heart to heart, involved with the trials and tragedies of the people around you, your family and friends, right? There's that simplicity of lifestyle where the big deal, it's like it is anywhere else. It's having people come to faith, get close with Jesus, be transformed. That's the biggest challenge on earth. No matter what society you're in, no matter what tier within the society you are at in terms of status, the biggest challenge is getting everybody right-minded with Jesus Christ. It's the most important thing that a person does in their life. And it's the hardest obstacle to surmount. In the simplicity of life, when you put away the pursuit, the lust of the rich man's gold, right? Like Leonard Skinner, Ronnie Van Zant wrote Simple Man, the lyrics of Simple Man. Forget your lust for the rich man's gold. All that you need is in your soul, right? That's a whole perspective shift for anybody who's ever heard that song that don't come up from the lower parts of society, the lower status, the lower class. You're middle class, upper middle class, upper class, noble class. You're any of that. This idea of giving up the lust for the rich man's gold and having all you need in your soul is a wildly different concept. When I first heard that song, I was living in that suburban world. I was not white trash. My parents came up out of refugee status and city status, right? Very similar to this trailer park situation, but city life, right? Rental, impoverished neighborhood, single parent thing, broken family, all this stuff I'm talking about, right? So my parents came up out of some of the lower echelons of social status and scratched and clawed their way up into the suburbs. Actually got into an upper middle class neighborhood where we frankly never belonged, right? They somehow did all right in spite of everything, you know. Of course, they didn't get along with one another, and the family wasn't healthy, and as a result, the kids were a little twisted, and a lot twisted, maybe. But that's where I lived. I lived in an upper middle class neighborhood in the suburbs when I first heard Lynyrd Skynyrd, I first heard Simple Man. That concept went right into me, and I got it right away. I got it. You know, the chase for gold, the chase for wealth, the chase for power is just an empty chase. You don't need all those things. The important things are elsewhere. What you need is in your soul. What's in your soul? You get down to it, that's God. God's there. God lives inside of us. And we're born that way. The breath of life, all that. Every single one of us, whether we like it or not, we have God. The only people that are walking around godless, they're not even godless. It's just they have closed off God to any kind of communion with inside of them. They got the hardened heart is what we call it. So in terms of heart and soul, yes, what we have in us is God. So our pursuit of God becomes the pursuit of love because God is love, and then it becomes a matter of the application of love when we interact with other people around us, and now we're starting to get into the important matters of life. And when we work together to help one another, right, givers and takers working in unison, and takers evolving into givers while other takers come along, now we are propagating goodness within troubling situations. We are mounting victories, battle after battle, in the comedy and tragedy of life, and all the meanwhile pursuing redemption and achieving sanctification. It's humongous what we go through when we change the focus away from the rat race pursuit of all this bullshit, right? All this bullshit. And Ronnie Van Zant put it very simply in a very basic, plain song, you know? And it's Mama told me when I was young, come sit beside me, my only son, right? So Mama is given instructions in life on how to be a person of heart and soul, and forget about all this greed and avarice, forget about all this status, all that shit, right? And now how many of us are actually living the way Ronnie Van Zant tells it as his mother told it to him? Very few. But when you look in the trailer parks, right, in spite of all the poverty, thievery, filth, drama, undisciplined children, immature men, drugs and alcohol, promiscuity, domestic violence, criminal records and jail time, you know, all the things that are desperados, you also have that simplicity of life where people are content within their status, within their culture, and they are not seeking to bust out of it in pursuit of vainglory. They're living by heart and soul, and that's always there to connect with one another, and these people end up being very connected to one another as a result. That's the beauty of those circumstances. It's the beauty of that culture. It's a hidden beauty, and you kind of got to just sit around, get in the middle of it, let it simmer, gain trust, you might say. Just start to feel it and start to recognize it. But it's fascinating, right? It's very fascinating. All right, so let's try to put a bow on this now, okay? Wrap it up and put it behind. Something that I brought up a time or two on the way through this series is this idea that a man cannot serve two masters, right? This is the mammon versus Christ idea. That's brought up in the Sermon on the Mount by Jesus Christ himself. Man cannot serve two masters. Now, mammon, of course, is wealth, treasure, things related to avarice, greed, right? So our pursuit of mastery of the physical world. Why? Because that's what money represents, right? Money is an exchange. It's representative of the worth of things in general, right? The worth of things in general. And when our mind is continually focused on that, that becomes our master, right? They're going back to what I was talking about with those California cults, those pyramid schemes, The Secret and EST and all the seminars that all these different guys get into. It's relation to prosperity gospel, right? The focus always on what I want, what I want, what I must have. And that's mammon. That is serving mammon. Christ, on the other hand, first and foremost, is not serving mammon. So it's going a completely different direction, right? So we are not looking out for what it is that we want and we must have. The opposite of that would be what somebody else wants, what somebody else must have. And who are we serving in that case? God, and God alone. It can't be another person. It can't be any other kind of created being. Let me tell you why. Because when we seek to serve another created being, we are ultimately serving ourselves anyway. Why? Think, who would you serve as a created being? You could serve a demon, or you could serve a person. What kind of person would you serve? Normally, it would be the objects of your romantic desire, right? Why people take wives when they don't have Christ in their life is because they want to serve that person, but they don't really want to serve that person. They want to be attached to that person, have that person serve them. And it becomes this mutual service. And that's not really what a marriage is all about. There's a union there, yes, but it's not a blessed union. It's not in covenant with Christ. It's for all the wrong reasons. There's an obvious selfishness goes with that, where people are concerned. We can only serve God without serving ourselves, because God is our, and you heard me say it before, good Father, which means what? Like I was talking about with discipline, right? God disciplines us, and in that discipline, it's squeezing parameters that help to transform us. That's what sanctification is all about. He's making us better people. Right? We do it voluntarily. The minute we bow out of it, it stops happening. Right? Now, we may get hard times that coax us back into order, or we may not. You know, we'd be lucky to get hard times. And that's the point I'm making. See, with God, you get a slap upside the head. It's not punishment. You have to understand that. That's a hard thing to understand, but you have to understand that. This is just like a father correcting the child. You know, teaching him how to ride a bike, teaching him how not to fall, teaching him how when he falls, how to get up without crying and get back on the bike and try again. There's discipline involved with that, you know, and there's, you know, a good father disciplines the children. So God is like that. We're not going to like what we get from God in so many cases. There's a lot of goodness that we do get. Beginning with the peace of Jesus Christ. If you don't know Jesus Christ, you don't know peace. If you don't know God, you don't know love. But you don't really know peace. You know, we chase after it. We pursue it in the 12 in the halls of 12-step recovery programs, AA, NA, and the like, right? When you really get down into the steps, which are the program of recovery, there's a pursuit of peace going on there. We call it serenity, right? The meetings open up with the serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, blah, 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 right? It's a really important thing. It's a really significant spiritual linchpin. It's a great and worthy ambition. But we cannot create peace for ourselves. We try to do that with meditations, and we try to do that with narcotics. We try to do that with oriental massage parlors, right? Whatever can get you calmed down. But that's not really peace. That's a false sense of it. That's euphoric pursuits and not actuality. You know, the only peace you get is the peace of Jesus Christ. And as a Christian, that is freely given, let me tell you. Anytime, any single time, I turn to Christ and ask for his peace within minutes, no matter what I'm involved with, that peace settles on upon me, and I'm able to make rational decisions where moments ago I was emotional, right? I get crazy. I get knocked around. I get disrespected. I get in confrontations. I have to hold myself back. You know, the violent urge that wells up in me. I don't want to make the next problem. I get scared of my own self. I need peace. You know, people will go take a shot of whiskey or more. People will take downers. You know, we like the Quaaludes we used to do back in the day, or the Mother's Little Helpers, little yellow pills, and barbiturates to calm your ass down. I don't have that luxury. I don't do drugs. I don't do alcohol. Where's peace going to come from? It's coming from God, and it comes from God like instantaneously, right? It's applied to me immediately, and it takes effect as quickly as the emotionalism is welled up in me to overcome, right? In other words, it may take a little longer in some cases to be overcome by the peace, but the peace is immediately dulled out to a Christian person who believes. And it's a remarkable thing. It helps to keep a level head, and it helps to keep me the reliable person in situations. Going with Christ is opposite and quite different than going with mammon, right? We're not looking for our pursuit. We're looking for what God wants of us. And that's a big-ass question mark. God wants a lot of us, but we have to kind of work with him. We have to be in contact with God to understand him. He speaks to us, each one of us, differently. He nudges us in different ways, different languages. And the closer we are with him, the more wide open our bond of communion is with him. It's called the nous, N-O-U-S, right? That's an actual like spiritual organ in our being. It's a very orthodox thing. It's a Greek word. Look it up on your own. I don't have time to explain it right here, right now. But it you know, that's like an organ that kind of opens and closes, and regulates the amount of love pouring in, the amount of God pouring into you, or pouring out for you, emanating out for you from you, in proportion with the close proximity and the intensity of your actual communion with God, right? We can close that thing down completely. Talking about the hardened heart before, right? The reprobate mind. You have a wall, a calcified wall built up. Nothing opens up between you and God anymore. You've turned your back on God, and you've decided to shut the door. You've been given the option to just say to hell with it forever and ever and ever, and that's it. And you shut it on God, and you're done, right? We can get to that point. I've come close. I believe I've come very close to that point in my life. And in the 11th hour, God started to chisel away the wall at my behest, right? And then finally, the light shone through and a connection was made. Once that communion is established, you walk hand in hand with God at that point in time. And no matter what comes up in your life, that peace is always readily at hand. All you got to do is ask. Sometimes you don't even have to ask, right? It's really just an incredible thing. But we're pursuing God instead of pursuing mammon, right? Which I explained thoroughly. And it's a real change of perspective. It's a real change of worldview to pursue God. Now, you're becoming what he wants you to be while you have no idea exactly quite what that is. So you just got to stay close to him. So the focus becomes doing the things that help keep close to God. And as time goes by, you could start to look back in retrospect and start to see some of the changes that have occurred in your life. And every once in a while, you'll run into somebody you ain't seen for a year, two, three, 10, 20 years, and they'll tell you exactly how you've changed. But I'm telling you right now, nobody is changing nothing without the presence of God, that communion with God attached. It could be a very small degree. It could be a larger degree. But it's got to be something, right? The change comes from God. All change in a person's being is a part of the transformation that we call sanctification. Whoever we are, whatever we believe, whether we know it or not, right? And I say these things because long before I was a Christian, that process of sanctification was already occurring with me. Again, with the 12-step program, it was God that made changes in my nature, in my character, my outlook, my tastes. That stuff was already happening on the path to Christianity, right? And again, my path to on Christianity, with the exclusion of what I inherited as a child, the Roman Catholicism, right? On my own volition, I entered Christianity through non-denominational Protestantism, and even still, you know, I understand that to be incorrect, incomplete, valid to a degree, right? But doctrinally questionable in almost every case. At least something, you know, something within the doctrine in every single case of Protestantism is heterodox, right? It's unorthodox. It's incorrect. There's always something. There's a distinction in every denomination, or two or ten, that deviate from orthodox doctrine. I believe now that the orthodox doctrine is the correct doctrine to go. That the practice, the worship is correct. It's what's intended. It's what was handed down to the first bishops from the apostles, who got it from Christ Himself. And who is the master of the Old Testament worship through the priests and the tabernacles and eventually the temple. And they get going back all the way back to the sacrifices laid down by Abel in the East of Eden. But anyway, without getting too far off track, we are talking about the differences between serving mammon and serving God, right? Serving God ultimately comes down to serving self, but we're not serving self in the same exact manner. We're serving self in a matter of accomplishing, becoming what God wants us to be. So all these things are done on His terms, His way. We don't have even a plan because we don't really know what good and what righteousness looks like for our case. I don't know which way to go. I don't know what to do. I just know get close to God and keep one foot in front of the other. And then whatever happens of it, I can get to identify as time goes by. And the changes can be observed for myself and from those around me. They're measurable. And again, all change belongs to God. All change is the sanctification of God, whoever you are, wherever you're at with God, right? Or you're not changing at all, or you can't change because you don't have any open line of communication whatsoever. People that don't believe God, people who are atheists even, right? They think in their beliefs there, well, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're closed off to the light of God in their hearts. We often have Christ in our being, present and emanating from us in spite of our own damn selves. Most of the world is actually like that. It's where you could find goodness in people. But see, the problem with goodness, all the goodness that we have is bastardized. It's corrupted by the evil that we have. We live in that knowledge of the good and evil, right? It's a conflation. You may have heard me talk about that before, but this conflation, this attempt at mixing good and evil together only serves to ruin that which is good. All that is evil is abominable. It's abominations. You can't mix holiness with abominations and expect it to be some kind of holy. It doesn't work that way. The evil corrupts the good. The good does not wash away the evil. It's sad but true, right? So to each of us, wherever we come from, whatever our beliefs are, we're caught in this conundrum. And those circumstances actually invalidate our essence and condemn us to the trash heap of Gehenna, which is the ever-burning fires outside the walls of Jerusalem, right? Which represent hellfire in the hereafter, right? We're cast to the waste heap, and that's happening to us before we're even conceived. We're garbage until we're not garbage anymore, but that's how we start out. So it's kind of something. You know, you talk about trailer trash, right? As a culture of people, okay, guess what? We're all trash of some sort. Whether we pile up in a dumpster in a trailer park, or whether we are in nice, neat green and blue receptacles that are wheeled out to our curbs once or twice a week, doesn't really matter. We're all trash, you know? And you're going to find in that trailer park, somebody is going to be lifted. Somebody is going to take the line of rescue, handed down from Christ, and is going to evolve well beyond the capability of billionaires and zillionaires who will end up frying in hell. So who is the rich man and who is the poor man? This is what I'm getting to. The wealth is in your spiritual pursuit. The wealth is in your your process of redemption. The wealth is in your salvation. The wealth is in the hereafter. And this is why Jesus Christ teaches about treasures in heaven. Never mind treasures on earth. Be mindful of the treasures in heaven. What is that? Well, first of all, it is eternal life. That is the ultimate treasure, right? The proximity, the everlasting proximity to God himself. And really the peace of God that we will likely become as a result of overcoming the world, the worldview, the mammon, the devils, the demons, other evil people, their influences, etc., so forth, right? It's so much. And this is why I can't bring these podcasts in. You know, I take a couple notes. I draw up a little framework just so I have something to keep the flow going. And my intention is, all right, we get an hour out of it. You know, 4 hours later, I'm still yip-yapping. It's so much. So those are some of the differences. Now, you think of like fame and fortune, right? We talk about mammon. You're talking about wealth, treasure, greed, avarice, all that. Think about how we are as people, right? We scrape and we struggle. We strive to overcome our present status and elevate in status, however which way we can, with the grand hope for everybody being fame and fortune, for whatever reason, to be discovered by some kind of producer or talent agency, talent scout, you know. Just be random lifted out of your condition, out of your circumstance, and plunked down into a higher level of status. We seek that. So we pursue fame and fortune in so many of our cases, right? And that is all owned by the devil, right? Fame and fortune. It's a controlled commodity. What do I mean when I say that? How is fame and fortune controlled? It does not happen organically. There are people in power, people of wealth, great wealth, who are subordinate to the devil, who is the prince of this world, who dictates, who can be part of that echelon of society. The doors are closed, open to only those who they choose to let in. You could take somebody, and I read a bunch of, like I was talking about, Weird Seeds Inside the Canyon, talking about the initial hippie bands coming out of the Los Angeles, you know, Sunset Strip scene in 65, right? The folk rock groups, which became the psychedelic groups, which became the country rock groups into the 70s. All these different musicians piling up, and in the beginning, half of them at least, were not really musicians. They could hardly play anything at all. They didn't have equipment. They just showed up there, right? So many of them were who? The children of very wealthy families, the children of families who were tied into the military industrial complex, families that were tied into military intelligence, it's really just an astonishing layout of the cross section of people that showed up in that area at that time who would turn around and become very famous, iconic musicians, which is ironic because, like I said, half of them knew nothing of music or very little. They showed no talent, you know. They may have developed it over the next 10 years, being immersed in it continually and having a master's of particular instruments on call at hand to learn from, right? But people were showing up that didn't know. They didn't know how to play. But they were made to be famous. There are people in this world that have the power to create fame out of a turd. And then there are people who are exceptionally gifted, talented, skilled, that will never come to fame because they don't meet the ultimate criteria. Right? Now, what we're talking about mythically in the United States is the devil at the crossroads, right? Robert Johnson, the old Delta blues guitar player, singer, out of the 20s and the 30s, right? One of the original members of Club 27, right? Musicians, actors, and entertainers that died at the age of 27. Robert Johnson, who ended up coming to fame and notoriety and recording here in Dallas, though he was a Mississippi Delta dude, down in Deep Ellum, right? Deep Ellum used to be a very black neighborhood, and the music down there was blues music, right? So there's a long-standing tradition of blues in Dallas, in DFW, that goes from that up to the Vaughn brothers, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan and his brother. And Deep Ellum is no longer Deep Ellum anymore. I don't want to go there for anything. But, however, just throw a little bit of Dallas and a little DFW, a little Texas in, just to get that in the mix here. The devil at the crossroads, right? That story, you got songs at the crossroads, like the crossroads. Eric Clapton did it, and Leonard Skinner had their version of it, going down to the crossroads. And here you make the deal with the devil. In the mythological story of Robert Johnson having his deal with the devil, he went down to the crossroads. And there's two versions of like where these crossroads are in Mississippi. I've been to both of them. One of them is the tourist area, and one of them is just some kind of unnoted, unrecognizable outpost out down in the country across from a Piggly Wiggly. I've been there. I've seen them both. And as the mythology goes, Robert Johnson was a blues guitar player. He was a kid. He was very fond of all the actual bluesmen, blues guitar players before him. And he would go in and play where they were playing, and he sucked so bad that they would kick him off a stage. You know, he was a punk-ass kid who didn't know what he was doing. And he disappeared for a year or two. And next time you saw him, he was the most gifted guitar player on earth. It happened like almost overnight. Now, there's a rational story to explain it. He had hooked up with a particular guy, and they went and sat in a graveyard every day of the week, sat on some, you know, tombstones, and he taught this kid how to play guitar, right? So there's a real story that makes sense, that really kind of puts the whole mythology of it away. But to continue with the mythology, is people suspected that he made off, and at a crossroads somewhere in the country, he held his guitar up to the devil and had the devil tune his guitar and made a deal for his soul, right? So that's the idea. You get a similar idea with the Charlie Daniels song, The Devil Went Down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind and he was way behind, so he was looking to make a deal, right? He had a golden fiddle, and he found a country boy, a redneck out there who was fiddling away, and he made a deal with this kid. He said, look, you play the fiddle, I'll play the fiddle. If you're better than me, I'll give you a fiddle made out of gold. Here's your gold, right? Here's your mammon. But if I'm better than you, you lose your soul. So it was a challenge, right? It wasn't tuning the guitar in exchange for the soul. It was a battle of the bands, basically, right? Between the devil and Johnny, I think was his name, right? Johnny in the song. And Johnny blew him away. So the devil handed him his fiddle made of gold. The premise is very similar. Right? We're talking about mammon. We're talking about fame and fortune. We're talking about the gateway into the elite crowd, the upper status people of this world. Right? You have to enter in with the devil's permission. You don't just organically, as a good, ordinary person, enter into that realm. It just don't happen like that. You may get access to the gate by means of your talents, but you ain't getting in. The door is closed to you. In fact, I was reading something or watching some video very recently. They talk about when you come to fame, when you come to prominence, when you make that step into the upper echelon of society, the guy who meets you at the gate shows up with a gun and a child. Think about that for a second. Once you even get to the gate, you're going in or you're going to die. You see that gate, it's the end for you. You have no choice but to do what you're told. You're already owned at that point. And what they're going to do is either kill that kid in front of you or make you kill that kid while they videotape you, right? That's the blackmail. And this is what I think I read something about this. Somebody like kind of let it out that this is what happens. You have your quote-unquote deal with the devil. You're probably sitting down with some kind of Talmudist attorney types. It could even be intelligence, central intelligence. You know, I don't know exactly who the guy is standing at the door. But when you hear tell of the guy standing at the door is going to hand you a gun with which you're going to kill a child, or he's going to point the gun at you and you're going to molest a child, they're going to get you on tape and they're going to have that to hold over your head forever and ever and ever, and now you become a puppet on a string. So just when you thought your fame and fortune was going to bring you freedom, independence, liberty, no, you actually just signed yourself over to the imprisonment of the devil. See how that works, right? So your pursuit of mammon, the ultimate precipice that you could bring yourself to, ends up being this prison. Oops. With God, that same pursuit, you end up with the ultimate freedom. You're released from the bondage of this world. But we don't see it coming. You know, we're short-sighted and we are egocentric. It's a lot to overcome, right? So all this is talking about, you know, comparing the paths, chasing after mammon and pursuing Christ, right? All of us are looking for some manner of a simple life. We're thinking if we had enough money and enough power, we can thereby have the simplicity of life and have no worries, right? As we call it, we have no worries. But is that ever true? Who are the most paranoid, freaked out people alive? It's these rich people in their ivory towers. You've heard me talk about this before. They're insane. They've done horrible things to come to their positions, to come to their status in this world. And they know they got the comeuppance, right? They know they got it coming back at them. And they also know that in the same way that they were out trying to take the money out of the pockets of people who had it, people are now coming to take their money away. And when their money goes away, so does their power, so does their false notion of any kind of freedom and independence. There is no such thing. There really is no such thing in this world. We are all slaves. We are all prisoners. And the only hope is getting out, right? Getting out. So when you get out, what happens? Is there freedom? Well, there's heaven and hell, as far as you would learn pursuing God through the doctrines of Christianity. There's heaven and hell. One of them is with God, and the rest of it is without God. Without God, you're not going to have any kind of freedom or liberty. So you can scratch that off. The only possibility left is what happens with God. Something to think about, right? Something to think about. I'm thinking of a Van Halen song that's popping into my head, Running with the Devil, right? That's your pursuit of mammon, running with the devil, the simple life. I found the simple life, ain't so simple, when I got out on that road. That's what I'm talking about. The higher up in status you get, the deeper into this shit you get. And when you actually enter through the gates of the elite, you are totally owned. You're absolutely a puppet on the string. And you can have the rug pulled out from you in a million different ways at any given time. Just the moment you buck their system, you're going to have problems, right? The simple life ain't so simple. Not with the devil it ain't, right? Not with the devil it ain't. Other lyrics in that song, right? Got no love, no love you'd call real. That's very perceptive. If you're running with the devil, you're not running with God. Whatever you think love is, it ain't. You think you got love, you don't. And if there's any love at all emanating out of you, just by your birthright of being a human being, like I explained in some detail before, I mean, the breath of life is in us. That's God. We all got it. It's just a matter of how connected we are to it, how wide open the channels are, right? And I don't know what David Lee Roth is saying when he says, got no love, no love you'd call real. Is he talking about romance love? Or is he actually deeper than that? I'm going to guess it's romance love. I got my reasons for believing that's what he's intending here, right? So even the romance ain't real, right? Surely it's not a thing of God for every reason in the world, because he's running with the devil, right? But then the romance, the romantic, quote-unquote romantic kind of love, that's not even real either. Why? Well, he's running with the devil. He's in pursuit of money. And the people he's going to meet along the way, guess what? They're the same kind of people. So if he starts making money, he's going to be surrounded by people who want to take it away from him all the time. And this is what makes these ivory tower scumbags so freaked out and paranoid. There's nothing real about that. There's no real friends when you get into that that corner of society. And that's how it starts to differ, you know, that down at the lowest levels in the trailer parks and whatnot, you know. There is a bit of authenticity with people down there. They share in the same strife, the same problems. They work together and help one another. It's not a perfect system. People come and go, faces change, but usually people end up returning where they came from, sooner or later. It's just the way it is. And then what happens is bonds establish, bonds reestablish, fondness deepens and grows, and there is a simplicity to it all, you know. There's drama, there's issues, there's problems, but you have a culture that for the most part is resolved to not pursuing fortune and fame, accepting that this is who I am. This is how I am. This is my status. This is my lot in life. And being good with that, right? How do we make the most out of the least? Bringing God into it. And I would have to say there's probably more God in the trailer park than there is in the Hollywood Hills. What do you think? You think I'm right with that? Think about it.
Thank you for tuning in to Post-Arlen Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.